Hey, podcast listeners, it's Anne Strangeamps here, and we've got something new this week, a To the Best of Our Knowledge Extra, an interview or a conversation that's so good we think you'd like to hear the whole thing. This week, we're bringing you Steve's conversation with Asna Sejrestad. She's an award-winning Norwegian journalist and war correspondent who covered the Anders Breivik case. And maybe you remember this. It was in 2011. A white supremacist named Anders Breivik shot and killed 69 people at a Norwegian summer youth camp. Most of the victims were teenagers. It was one of the biggest mass murders in modern history and, of course, a national trauma for Norway. And it's been on our minds because of the shooting in Orlando, because there's been a lot of speculation about Omar Mateen's motivations. There's a lot that we still don't know about his politics and his psychology. But when you listen to this interview, I think you'll hear similarities between the two gunmen. And their politics were different, but they were both alienated, self-radicalized loners. So as we struggle to learn what we can from Orlando, maybe there are things we can learn from this story of another terrorist and another country's response. Here's Steve Paulson's conversation with Asna Sejrestad about her book, One of Us, the story of Anders Breivik and the massacre in Norway.
Asna, your book is called One of Us, which is a curious title because it would seem that Anders Breivik is precisely not like any other Norwegian. He's a mass murderer, a neo-Nazi, probably a psychopath. Why do you say he's one of us?
Well, first of all, he was born like one of us. He's a fellow Norwegian, typical in many senses. And then at some point, he decides to go against all of us. But if we portray him like a monster, something, you know, almost extraterrestrial or something, it would be too easy to say, you know, he's ill, he's sick, he's mean, he's evil, he's not one of us. And it would make us easier to say, you know, this is never going to happen again because he was a special case. But then again, when you look at his life, he was not a special case. When you go through his life, you see that he's actually quite normal. It's normalcy that even though he has, as you say, some traits that are not very common, it's also the normalcy that strikes you.
Hmm. So even though he committed this horrible atrocity, I mean, you know, killing 77 people, you do not use the word evil to describe him.
Oh, his actions are definitely evil. And I think, yes, he's evil. I think you could say that about him. But none of us are born evil. That does not exist. Where does it start? So where should we start to hate him? Of course, there's so many reasons to hate him. And I've been working so closely with the parents who lost their children. When I started the book, it wasn't even enough to start with his birth. You had to have a close look at his parents, even at his grandparents. This is definitely a child. He doesn't get the care that a child deserves. And then he goes out in the world and tries to find a place to belong. And he's hassled and he's harassed. And at some point, his evil mentality develops, but it wasn't there from the beginning. So it's a lifespan of a terrorist. When does he become a terrorist? When does he become evil? That's an interesting question.
Yeah. Well, we should just briefly sketch the outlines of his early life. I mean, as you say, he had a pretty miserable childhood. I mean, his father basically abandoned him when he was very little. He grew up with an unstable mother. I mean, probably mentally ill. Never really fit in and wanted to fit in, but just couldn't for whatever reason and just seemed to become an extreme loner.
Yeah, and there's so many, unlucky combinations in his life. Because, yes, he had a bad childhood, but it's like, I'm sure you have millions of children in the world who have much worse childhoods than him.
Right, who don't become murderers then, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So what makes a murderer and what makes a man commit evil actions like that? And someone's used the term the perfect storm, which needs, you know, the perfect speed, the perfect temperature, the exact humidity and so on to make, you know, a storm that happens, you know. And it's a bit like that with him, that probably something genetic. He has a history of mental illnesses in the family. Then it's definitely the lack of a father. And that's also interesting when you see many of the terrorists, the Islamic terrorists, the foreign fighters going to Syria. That's one unifying factor, a lack of a father. So then it's the instability at home, instable mothers, if we can, you know, talk in headlines here a bit. And the worst thing you can do to a child is to not make him or her develop or feeling secure and safe. So she has this love-hate relationship to her son. I love you, I hate you, I wish you were never born, I want to give you away, I want to give you to, you know, foster care. And then in the next moment, she would hug him, they would sleep tied together at night. And then the next morning, it's like that goes right into the development of a personality. And if the child doesn't feel secure, and this is important, it should happen within, you know, the first 18 months.
Yeah.
If the child doesn't have a secure attachment to a mother or father, could be anyone, but it has to be someone, that goes straight into the development of empathy too. So definitely that is a bad start. And then there's something about him that makes him not be welcome in many milieus. In his childhood, he reshapes himself and he remakes himself so many times to try to fit in there, in that gang with
right.
These
he tries to join various groups, and they always end up rejecting him. And eventually, as a young man, then he basically just goes off and spends years playing video games like World of Warcraft and Call of Duty.
Yeah, and definitely. And again, World of Warcraft has 10 million users worldwide. So, of course, he's the only one who became a terrorist, or one of few. But it's, again, this combination for him that was a terrible thing to do. Because, as you said, he tries to find a place to belong. He's rejected because there's something about him that people just don't, you know, they don't want him around. There's something. Not always when I talk to, these youngsters afterwards, it's not always they could say what it was. They were just like, you know, he was not fun to hang around with. He was just things like that. And then he loses his money because he desperately wants to become rich, because he wants to be admired, he wants to be seen, he wants to be something big. He wants his father, who didn't see him since he saw him occasionally every summer holiday. But after he was 15, he never saw him again. He didn't want to see his son. So Anders Breivik was going around telling his friends, if I did something really great, something really big, maybe my father would see me. So,
one thing that's striking is in some ways how similar Anders Breivik is to the people he detests. I mean, the kinds of the people who would go join Al-Qaeda, for instance, who've also committed brutal murders. I mean, it's the outsider who feels rejected by society, who feels isolated, and then looks for a grand cause and has violent fantasies that will bring him glory.
Yeah, and it's true that all extremists resemble, whether they are white supremacists like he is, or Sunni Muslim Islamist supremacists as ISIS is. They have the same worldview of dividing us and them, good and bad, and ranging people like we're on top, below us are, for Breivik, the Muslims, for ISIS would be the Christians or the Yazidis and the Jews, and this wanting to cleanse, this wanting to purify the world, or the caliphate, or in Anders Breivik's case, in his manifesto that he wrote, to purify Europe from all Muslims and all Muslim influence. So they definitely resemble, and Breivik had a deep admiration for Al-Qaeda, and he's very inspired by them. That's what he writes in the manifesto.
Part of his manifesto was, you know, the problem of Muslims coming to Norway. I mean, he hated
definitely
Muslim immigrants.
But he admires their devotion and their methods. So when he's trying to make the bomb, he's looking at different manuals, you know, on the net, and he would find something from Al-Qaeda, something from research institutes. He's a bit like a little scientist, picking and finding out, because it's not easy to make a big bomb, apparently. I think he loses something in those years where he sits there in front of a computer screen, where he's playing World of Warcraft.
Yeah,
and he sits. He moves in with his mother. He's then 27 years old. He moves in with his mother for 3 full years. He plays nonstop, round the clock, World of Warcraft, and he does project these video games onto his plans of committing a massacre.
You said that the interesting question is when he became evil. I mean, he wasn't born that way. He committed these horrible acts. I mean, arguably the biggest trauma in Norway since the Second World War, since the Nazi occupation.
Yeah, it's probably, even though I posed the question myself, it's probably the wrong question, because he doesn't see himself as evil. He sees himself as doing good. Just as the Islamists in ISIS and in Syria would say, they're doing good because he's a savior. He sees himself as a savior because he has these statistics of, you know, in 100 years there will not be any more blue eyes in Norway or blonde hair or this or that. So that he sees himself as a savior. I'm sure, even Hitler wouldn't see himself as evil, on the opposite, that he's saving Germany. And that also in this crazy mind of Anders Breivik. But when does that start? I think it comes quite late. So when he's on these video games, slowly he's going onto the even darker sides of the internet, which is the fascist sides, the white supremacist sides and the neo-Nazi sides and anti-immigration, anti-Islamist sides and so on. And he, of course, again, he wants to suck up to the leaders, as he'd done all his life, trying to be a member of a gang. He wants to be a member of this gang. And then in the last moment, he's even rejected here. One of those who he'd contacted said that he hadn't bothered to answer him because, not because he was extreme, but because he was so boring. That's what everybody says about him. And he is a bit, you know, he is a bit of a bore. He doesn't really have that ability to inspire people. And so he's rejected even here. That was January of 2010. He gets the last rejection of the Progressive Party members. The next month in February, that's when he starts to buy the weapons.
Yeah.
Before that, he's never, ever committed any violence in his life, ever. But then he starts buying the weapons, the ammunition, and he's so clever in planning all this. Everything is bought legally. He signs up in a pistol club. So everything is bought properly. And then he starts buying ingredients for the bomb. He rents a farm in order to be able to buy all those fertilizers, even all of that, all the chemicals, everything is something you can buy on the internet. Mm.
Let's talk for just a little bit about July 22nd, 2011, when he killed all these people, 77 people. I mean, first he blew up the government building, hoping to kill the prime minister, killed, 8 people there, and then went off to this island where lots of young students were, killed many dozens of students there. What was the hardest part for you reporting on all of this? I mean, you go into great detail about, I mean, once he was on that island, he would just walk from one kid to the next, shooting them in the head.
Yeah, he spared no one. And that's when I think this video game mentality comes in. You know, he was not sadist in the way of enjoying it. He would be screaming around things like, you know, I'll kill you all today, I'll kill you all, Marxists. But he just shot and left, shot and left, shot and left. Just like in a video game, you just... If there were people at his left, people at his right, he would always go towards the bigger crowd where he could get more. So it's like it's very mechanical. He's found this, made himself this mixture of adrenaline, of coffee and a few other ingredients to kind of pacifies emotions in a way. But he said in court, after having put the bomb in the government area, driving to the island and getting off that little ferry, he was going to start the massacre. And he said to himself, I can't do it. I can't do it. It's impossible. It's against nature. He was like, he was not able to, you know, just put down his hand and get out his gun. But then at some point he felt like he was surrounded and felt that, okay, if I don't start, they're going to understand that I'm a fake policeman, because he was dressed in a police uniform. And then he took his hand to his thigh where he had the gun, and he shot the guard, and then the second guard, and then the third guard of the island. And then he said, after the first shot, it was all easy.
Wow. So he had to get past that initial resistance. And once he'd done that, it just killing was not a problem anymore.
It was all easy. Beforehand, he had been calculating how many people he needed to kill to be famous. And to be famous, he wanted to be read, because he wrote that big manifesto of 1,500 pages. And he called the massacre his book launch, because he wanted his manifesto to be read. And he decided that he needed to kill minimum 12 people. He was like, that's probably enough to be, you know, become worldwide famous, worldwide known. And then he ended up killing 77 kids. Not even when he was asked by the police the day after, how many people do you think you've killed? He thought like maybe 30 or 40. It seems like he did it like in a trance almost.
At the trial of Anders Breivik, there was a big debate about whether he should be declared insane. And Breivik himself desperately wanted to be declared sane. I mean, he wanted to use his trial as a political platform. And in the end, he was not found to be insane, right?
No, and I think that was the right verdict, actually. In Norway, the red line is psychosis, meaning if you're under psychosis, having voices in your head telling you you have to kill, you know, there's no way back, you don't really have a choice, then you will be judged insane. But he knew he had a choice. He had been planning this for 1.5 years. He could at any moment step back. And from the island, he even called the police twice. And he said, I'm Anders Breivik, I'm on this island, I surrender. But, you know, every time he called, he came to, you know, just the dispatch, or he came to a person without authority.
Wait, they did nothing with those calls? I mean, he was basically giving himself up and they didn't respond right away?
No, the problem was also, I mean, it was a terrible police work on that day. But when it comes to this, it was also he had a mobile without a SIM card. He just took off some victim because he left his own phone in a car and it exploded. So he had to take a phone off some kids. So there was no number showing for the police. He said, call me back. And there was actually, even for the police at that time, there was no way they could call him back, because there was no phone number showing. So yes, it was terrible. But he wanted to surrender, because he wanted to survive. Because he saw the first phase, that was the massacre. Second phase was the trial that, as you said, he saw as his stage. And the third phase was the worldwide conservative revolution, as he says it, that other young people, groups, would be inspired by his actions and continue his course.
Now, for someone like me who lives in the United States, where this kind of murder, I mean, this mass murder, often leads to a death sentence, it is astonishing how different the Norwegian legal response has been. I mean, Breivik was given the maximum sentence of only 21 years in prison. And the assumption is he'll be released after that, unless he's still considered a threat to society, or if he's still considered a terrorist.
Yeah, he will never be released. He will always be dangerous. So there's no way, I think, that he can be released. And I also think that should we change our laws because of one person, he would have won. He wants a society with a death penalty. He was talking about that in court. You know, I hope I'll get the death penalty, would say things like that. Yes, 21 years is the maximum penalty. But if you pose a danger to society after that, every 5 years, it can be extended until death. And it has happened before. He will not be the only one. 5 years on, 5 years on, 5 years on, because he's too dangerous. He can't be let loose in the open. And I think He was 32 when he committed the crime. So 20 years after, he will be 53. He's fit. He's running. He has his own treadmill. He's doing, you know, he's doing his push-ups every day. It's like, when he's 53, he's going to be just as dangerous. So it's like, no way. Even though he regrets, he can't be trusted. Because
wait, does
so
he regret? Has he expressed remorse?
No. The only thing he regrets is that he didn't kill more. That's what he said in court. So, of course, that's rhetorics too. But what he feels inside, I don't know. What he's disappointed about is that he didn't get that following he'd hoped for. He's now complaining about how difficult it is for him to be isolated, how difficult it is for him to be in prison. And he says it's amounts to torture the way he's being treated in prison, because he sits isolated. He can't see other inmates. So he's sometimes like a big child complaining.
I mean, the irony cannot be overstated here, that he would complain about, you know, not being treated well in prison.
Yeah. And that's a man who, you know, he killed 77 people. The youngest one was 14 years and 3 days old. Half of them were under 18. They were kids. And these were, you know, young, aspiring politicians on a summer camp from the Social Democratic Party, spending a week that summer to learn about, you know, climate change or, you know, women's rights, things like that. Yeah, his complaints are, as you know, they are pathetic.
Have you had contact with Breivik, either during the process of writing the book or after it came out?
Yeah, we exchanged letters at some point. I wanted to interview him after the trial because I was thinking, okay, I'm a journalist. I have to go to the sources. I have to ask for an interview. And then I did that. He never responded. And then 1 year after I sent him that letter, I had a letter in my mailbox. And that was a letter where he wanted to cooperate and tell his story. But then he had to write half the book. So he said, okay, let's write the book together. You write the beginning and the end, and I will write the middle. And then I'll grant you an interview. And it's like, well, yeah, it wasn't really possible. So, yeah. And then it was some letters back and forth. It was interesting because I learned more about his personality. And then he read the book, and after read it, he said, I don't want this book ever to be mentioned. I don't want the name of this journalist ever to be mentioned again in my presence. He told some researchers. So he definitely did not like the book. It's not the way he wants to be portrayed, because he wants to be seen as a savior, as a big hero. And then what I've found in the book is all, you know, all the flaws, all the things he struggled with in life. And he's definitely not coming out as a hero.
Yeah. Well, for any journalist, there is a big ethical question about what you do with a story like this, because mass murderers like Breivik crave public attention and they want to become famous. And you could argue that the best media response would be to say nothing about their murders. And of course, it's totally unrealistic given this kind of violence. I mean, especially the scale of this violence. Did you have any hesitation about writing this book because you were, to some degree, you know, playing into that fantasy of celebrity for him?
No, I wasn't. Remember, this was everywhere in Norway. The event, it was such a changing event for Norway. But I think that whatever is not known, that's where you'll get rumors. That's where you get, you know, theories, conspiracy theories. That's where you get, you know, whatever's in the shade, that's where anything can be said. So I believe in, you know, get out the facts, get out his miserable childhood, also for reasons, you know, that is a cause. Childhood is important, or, you know, gaming is important, the making of a terrorist. On all subjects, we need to know the facts. And also, it showed that he never became a hero for anyone. And that's interesting to see, even among the very far-right milieus in Europe, he's never lifted up. There's something about him, as there's always been. There's something unlikable about him, even among those people. So, of course, there's a little fan club of his in Russia. I've heard there's one in Serbia. I haven't checked that out. But it's like, that's a couple of people, and they definitely haven't read my book because that fan club started earlier. But it's like even now with the rise of the right wing in Europe, nobody picks him out as anything. It's like to kill those kids, it's not heroic for anyone.
You said that this massacre that he committed changed Norway. I mean, it's a different country now. Can you explain that?
Well, yeah, in depth, it has not changed us in depth because, you know, we stand on solid rock in this country. It's a very peaceful, calm, harmonious country. But we were swept off our feet back then, 5 years ago, and really had to just like redefine our values. But I think that Norway kind of came back to its core values and words like, you know, community and solidarity and tolerance and love, those words that sometimes are just, you know, beautiful words, but without the content, they really regain their true content after this terrible terror attack. So most of Norway was standing together. And of course, it showed also weaknesses, definitely in the police work, and probably, definitely, I would say, the police had been too naive that something like that could never have happened to Norway. So they were not up for that, task that day on the 22nd of July. But it has, you know, hurt us, and it has, it will always be there as a wound. But on the whole, it hasn't really changed Norway. And not like, I would say that September 11th in the US changed U.S. a lot.
You go into tremendous detail about Anders Breivik's life, about the day of all the killings. I mean, into tremendous detail about, you know, the various people who were killed and how he walked around shooting them all. What was the hardest part for you in telling the story, doing the research?
To talk to the parents of these teenagers, because I felt, when I contacted them, I felt that I was intruding into a family, intruding into a grief. And still I knew I had to do it, but I was postponing it. And also I knew that I couldn't really interview, like, you know, 10 families and then just choose, you know, the best two or three. I had to stick to those that I interviewed. And so I had to do a lot of research beforehand, because for such long stories, you need to find solid people, because grief can all very suddenly turn into anger, which is in one of families it does. But I was very afraid it would turn their anger against me. I didn't want to change their grief into something, because then it wouldn't have been a truthful presentation of it. So that was tough. And that was for me, I covered so many wars and terrible situations in Afghanistan and in Iraq, in Chechnya, and interviewed victims and interviewed families. And it's more like a job when it's far away. So it was interesting how doing this in Norway it could have been my kids, you know, these parents were my age. These kids became like, you know, my grief too.
Did these families want to talk to you?
Yeah, they did. So how did I choose? Because there's only three main families in the book. They kind of chose themselves. So what happened during the trial, there was a woman at some point coming up to me, and she'd read that I was writing a book. So she said, "I'm glad you're writing that book because I read your book from Iraq." And she had lost her daughter, who was a Kurdish-Iraqi refugee. And then I realized that that's a very important story, because they fled from Iraq to find a safe place for their daughters. And later they also got a son. And then the oldest daughter was killed in Norway by a white supremacist. So that story was important. And then there's a very strong guy whose name is Viljar, who's shot 5 times on the island, first in his thigh, in his shoulder, in his arm, and then last through his eye. So he loses an eye and he, you know, his whole head. The brain, actually, it's the doctors don't understand how it's possible. The brain was lying outside of his skull. And then the policeman who came after the massacre, they think he's dead, so they don't take him. And then some girl is screaming. He was just singing because he was rambling at some point. And then a policeman comes up to him and he finds this little pulse of this boy. And the policeman was a former soldier from Afghanistan, so he knew this war injuries. So he put the brain back into the skull and patched it together as you would do with a ceramic bowl or something. Got him into this boat. This is a, you know, little boat, cabin cruiser kind of little boat. Taking him over to the other side. There's a helicopter waiting to take him to the hospital. He's in coma for 10 days. And there's one night when he's getting so cold and the doctor's telling the parents, you know, now he's about to, you know, this is the end. But you have one last chance to give him the will to live. He must have the will to live. He must want to live. You know, this night, talk to him, cuddle him, do whatever. And then a friend of his is coming and he's talking about, you know, what they will do when they will get out. He's still in coma. He doesn't respond. He just lies there. And at some point, this friend is starting to sing. And he's singing a song that they, you know, sang together. And early morning that, you know, after a long night, the boy in the bed, Viljar, starts to sing along with his friend. Then he's back into coma, but then that's the start. And this boy now, he is he's studying psychology at the university now. Now he's on his third year. He's blind on one eye. He doesn't have a shoulder. He can't ski any longer. He can't do all those things that he loved to do before. But that boy was testifying in court, and I was thinking, you know, that boy has to be part of the book. And he went to Utøya with his best friends. There were three. He was the only one to come back. So his two best friends are the two other main characters of the book. And that's it. That's how I found them. And that's they represent friendship and they represent family and the losing of a sibling for the two Kurdish sisters. So that was all I needed for the book.
Wow. What an amazing story of human resilience.
Yeah, I think it's important in the book that there are, you know, also stories of survival. Yeah, it's dark to get to know Breivik. It's not a nice, you know, it's not someone you really would want to get to know. I have to be honest to say, you know, I'm happy or glad that I'm done with him. I'm never going to go back. I'm done with that guy. I know now he wanted to sue Norway because, you know, this things in prison that he's not pleased how he's being treated. And I heard that on the radio. I was thinking, oh, I don't need to care about it. I'm done with him.
Wow. You've just done an amazing reporting job here. Thank you so much for coming in to talk about this.
Thank you for having me.
That's the Norwegian journalist Asna Sejrestad talking with Steve Paulson. Her book is called One of Us, the story of Anders Breivik and the massacre in Norway. And this is the sound of 40,000 Norwegians protesting at the Anders Breivik trial. They gathered outside the courthouse and sang a children's song. It's actually a version of a Pete Seeger song called My Rainbow Race. It's a song about peace and love and brotherhood. And they sang it because during his trial, Breivik said it was being used to brainwash children. I'm Anne Strainchamps. This was a To the Best of Our Knowledge Extra. To hear more, check out our website, ttbook.org.